You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Well, it's official, ladies and gentlemen. We just got a call from a reporter from Channel 5 News in Phoenix. The court has issued a bench warrant for the arrest of myself and my wife. We are ready to resist with ever, whatever force is necessary should they come up here and attempt to arrest us for any reason whatsoever. And if you listened to the broadcast day before yesterday, and if you continue listening today, you're going to eventually arrive at the conclusion that we're in the right and they're in the wrong. Unless you're just going to back up the government no matter what, my country, right or wrong, just like Hitler's SS stormtroopers did. Remember the excuses they gave at Nuremberg for murdering all those people? Oh, they were just backing their government, just following orders, just doing what they were supposed to do as good little Nazi German citizens. Not me, folks. I've spent my time stupid. I went to fight a war in Vietnam that had nothing to do with freedom or the Constitution or the Bill of Rights or anything that we hold dear in this country, although I thought I was at the time. Now I'm really fighting for freedom in this country. It makes me feel damn good. So, make sure you take notes, listen closely. We'll continue with the lecture on federal jurisdiction that we did, or that I did, I should say, on May 25th from the material provided by attorney Larry Becraft, many others, and of course, a lot of my research. And it's all backed up, documented with court cases, and I've sent an entire brief to Sheriff Art Lee, who, by the way, called the FBI and told them they weren't welcome to come in this county and harass this family. And I understand at least one other significant ranking law enforcement person in this county has done the same thing. So to Sheriff Lee and whoever else is helping us out, however large or small that help may be, I thank you.
Have had many opportunities to construe and apply this clause of the Constitution. The essence of all these decisions manifests a legal principle that the states of this nation have exclusive jurisdiction of property and persons located within their borders, excluding such lands and persons residing thereon which have been ceded to the United States. Concur in the session will be derived from the whole people of the state in their adoption of the Constitution. Every imaginable objection seems to be obviated. The necessity of a like authority in reports, magazines, etc., established by the general government is not less evident. The public money expended on such places and the public property deposited in them require that they should be exempt from the authority of the particular state. Nor would it be proper for the places on which the security of the entire Union may depend to be in any degree dependent on a particular member of it. All objections and scruples are here also obviated by requiring the concurrence of the states concerned in every such establishment. End quote. Since the ratification of the present United States Constitution, the United States Supreme Court and all lower courts have had many opportunities to construe and apply this clause of the Constitution. The essence of all these decisions manifests a legal principle that the states of this nation have exclusive jurisdiction of property and persons located within their borders, excluding such lands and persons residing thereon which have been ceded to the United States. Not just jurisdiction, but exclusive jurisdiction. Perhaps one of the earliest decisions on this point was, which involved a federal prosecution for a murder committed on board the warship Independence, anchored in the harbor of Boston, Massachusetts. The defense complained that only the state had jurisdiction to prosecute this crime and argued that the federal circuit courts had no jurisdiction of this crime supposedly committed within the federal government's admiralty jurisdiction. An argument before the Supreme Court, counsel for the United States admitted as much. Quote, "The exclusive jurisdiction which the United States have in forts and dockyards ceded to them is derived from the express assent of the states by whom the cessions are made. It could be derived in no other manner, because without it, the authority of the state would be supreme and exclusive therein," end quote. In holding that the state of Massachusetts had jurisdiction over this crime, the court held, quote, "What then is the extent of jurisdiction which a state possesses? We answer without hesitation. The jurisdiction of a state is coextensive with its territory, coextensive with its legislating power. The article which describes the judicial power of the United States is not intended for the cession of territory or of general jurisdiction. Congress has power to exercise exclusive jurisdiction over this district and over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. It is observable that the power of exclusive legislation, which is jurisdiction, is united with cession of territory, which is to be the free act of the states. It is difficult to compare the two sections together without feeling a conviction not to be strengthened by any commentary on them that, in describing the judicial power, the framers of our Constitution had not in view any section of territory or, which is essentially the same, of general jurisdiction," end quote. The ship upon which the crime was committed was sitting in the harbor, which had not been ceded by the legislature of the state of Massachusetts to the United States of America. Does everybody understand that? Now, what would they do today? They'd say the state had no authority, the federal government would try the person for the crime, and nobody would even challenge it, because nobody understands it.
Probably use the 12-mile boundary regulation.
They can have all the regulations they want, but regulations do not apply when they are unconstitutional, are not enforceable, have no lawful standing, period. Any law which is an unconstitutional law is null and void upon its very implementation. The court in Bevins thus established a principle that federal jurisdiction extends only over the areas wherein it possesses the power of exclusive legislation, and this is a principle incorporated into all subsequent decisions regarding the extent of federal jurisdiction. To hold otherwise would destroy the purpose, intent, and meaning of the entire United States Constitution. The decision in Bevins was closely followed by decisions made in two state courts and one federal court within the next 2 years. In Commonwealth v. Young, Brightly, NP 302-309, Pennsylvania, 1818, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania was presented with the issue of whether lands owned by the United States, for which Pennsylvania had never ceded jurisdiction, had to be sold pursuant to state law. In deciding that the law of Pennsylvania exclusively controlled the sale of federal land, the court held, and I quote, "The legislation and authority of Congress is confined to cessions by particular states for the seat of government and purchases made by consent of the legislature of the state for the purpose of erecting forts. The legislative power and exclusive jurisdiction remained in the several states. Of all territory within their limits, not ceded to or purchased by Congress with the assent of the state legislature to prevent the collision of legislation and authority between the United States and the several states," end quote. A year later, the Supreme Court of New York was presented with the issue of whether the state of New York had jurisdiction over a murder committed at Fort Niagara, a federal fort. In People v. Godfrey, 17 Johns, 225, 223, New York, 1819, that court held that the fort was subject to the jurisdiction of the state. Since the lands, therefore, had not been ceded to the United States, fort be damned. Do you understand? They're pulling a scam job on us, big time. Quote, to oust this state of its jurisdiction, to support and maintain its laws, and to punish crimes, it must be shown that an offense committed within the acknowledged limits of the state is clearly and exclusively cognizable by the laws and courts of the United States. In the case already cited, Chief Justice Marshall observed that to bring the offense within the jurisdiction of the courts of the Union, it must have been committed out of the jurisdiction of any state. It is not, he says, the offense committed, but the place in which it is committed, which must be out of the jurisdiction of the state. The decisional authority upon which this court relied was United States versus Bevins Supra. At about the same time that the New York Supreme Court rendered its opinion in Godfrey, a similar fact situation was before a federal court. The only difference being that the murder was committed on land which had been ceded to the United States. In United States versus Cornell, 25, Fed case, 646-648, number 14,867, C.D.R.I.1819, the court held that the case fell within federal jurisdiction. Quote, but although the United States may well purchase and hold lands for public purposes, within the territorial limits of a state, this does not of itself oust the jurisdiction of sovereignty of such state over the lands so purchased. It remains until the state has relinquished its authority over the land, either expressly or by necessary implication. Quote, when, therefore, a purchase of land for any of these purposes is made by the national government and the state legislature has given its consent to the purchase, the land so purchased by the very terms of the Constitution ipso facto falls within the exclusive legislation of Congress and the state jurisdiction is completely ousted, end quote. Almost 18 years later, the United States Supreme Court was again presented with a case involving the distinction between state and federal jurisdiction. In New Orleans versus United States, 35, United States Supreme Court, 10 Pet, 662-737, 1836, the United States claimed title to property in New Orleans, likewise claimed by the city. After holding that title to the subject lands was owned by the city, the court addressed the question of federal jurisdiction. Quote, special provision is made in the Constitution for the cession of jurisdiction from the states over places where the federal government shall establish forts or other military works. And it is only in these places or in the territories of the United States where it can exercise a general jurisdiction, end quote. Now listen to what it says, or in the territories of the United States where it can exercise a general jurisdiction. You know why people allow United States marshals to come and do their work within a state, or to come and arrest citizens of a state? Because we were all brainwashed that they have the authority to go anywhere and do anything by the tales and the stories and the history of the old marshals in the territorial West. What do we see in the movies? Wyatt Earp, United States Marshal. Come to get your boy. Hey, you going, Marshal? Draw, are you villain? Right? That's why we don't think twice when the United States Marshal comes to our door and serves us with a paper or arrests us or carts off our property or our levies and seizes or anything else, do we? Do they have the right to do that? Can they do it? No, not if you know the law and understand it. You can throw the sucker in prison because he's operating under the color of law as an outlaw outside the law. He is breaking the law, or she is, the case may be. They're criminals. Now, they don't know that because they were hired to do a job. When they got hired to do the job, did somebody give them a constitution and sit them down and teach them this stuff? No. They sat them down, told them what they wanted to do, and said that if they didn't do it, they'd get poor performance marks or they'd be fired, right? And so these poor fools are just like the rest of us poor fools. They're just going around being manipulated, committing crimes against their fellow citizens because they think they're doing their job. And when you question what they're doing, they think you're the nut. Because their supervisor would never tell them to do something unlawful, would they? Would they? No. No, sir, they wouldn't do that, would they? In New York versus Milne, 36, United States Supreme Court. I got to pause here and change the tape. Let's take a 5-minute break, guys.
The question before the court involved an attempt by the City of New York to assess penalties against the master of a ship for his failure to make a report regarding the persons his ship brought to New York, as against the master's contention that the act was unquestionable, unconstitutional, and that New York had no jurisdiction in the matter. The court held, quote, if we look at the place of its operation, we find it to be within the territory, and, therefore, within the jurisdiction of New York. If we look at the person on whom it operates, he is found within the same territory and jurisdiction. End quote. And again, quote, same court ruling. They are these, that a state has the same undeniable and unlimited jurisdiction over all persons and things within its territorial limits as any foreign nation, where that jurisdiction is not surrendered or restrained by the Constitution of the United States. You realize what this says? This rogue federal agent who is committing criminal acts within the territorial jurisdiction of the state is what? He's under state jurisdiction, isn't he? He can be arrested by the county sheriff or the city police, or if your state has a state police or highway patrol or whatever you call it, tried, convicted, and thrown in prison. And the federal government can't save him. That's incredible, isn't it? Are these speakers working? Huh? Doesn't sound like it, does it? Testing, testing?
No.
Not working. What happened? Anybody turn anything off over there?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, God. You guys not mess with the electrical connections, please?
Sorry.
It's always Bob. I know. Whenever somebody comes and tells me they're going to do something for my own good, I run as fast as I can. Please don't do anything for my own good. That by virtue of this, it is not only the right, but the bounden and solemn duty of a state to advance the safety, happiness, and prosperity of its people, and to provide for its general welfare by any and every act of legislation which it may deem to be conducive to these ends. Where the power over the particular subject or the manner of its exercise is not surrendered or restrained in the manner just stated, that all those powers which relate to merely municipal legislation, or what may perhaps more properly be called internal police, are not thus surrendered or restrained, and that consequently, in relation to these, the authority of a state is complete, unqualified, and exclusive. Pretty heavy, isn't it? What do you think would happen if every sheriff in the country understood this? Do they understand it? Why don't they understand it? Who has the answer to that? Because the sheriff is you, isn't he? Is the sheriff trained in law? I'll tell you what, if he was, we'd be in even more trouble. Because they don't teach this in law schools either. But he's not trained. He doesn't study this. Who is the sheriff? In every county in this country, who is the sheriff? He's Joe Blow citizen, just like people sitting in this room and people walking around out there, ignorant, who gets elected to the position. Most times he's no more qualified than my Aunt Maisie sitting in her rocking chair doing her knitting is qualified to be president of the United States. Which is not to say that she isn't. But there's no proof that she is. I can tell you this, I wouldn't want her to be. Because I know her. So, what's your job? Educate your sheriff. I've educated mine to the point where when somebody asks him to write a column for a newspaper, he brings it over to me and I write it. I write it for him. Some 8 years later, in the question of federal jurisdiction was once again before the court. This case involved a real property title dispute with one of the parties claiming a right to the contested property via a U.S. patent. Did you ever hear of a U.S. patent? How many of you have a U.S. patent on your property? Nobody? You do? Would you explain to them what a U.S. patent is?
You're talking about the land patent?
Mm-hmm.
I heard about a lot of this stuff. And what I had done is I sent this through internet, BLM, I was trying to BLM patent. Cost me $2.68 to get 2 certified copies. Now, I haven't followed through all the way, but the land patent is for 160 acres, and all I have to do is pull my part out at 160 acres, and this will give me clear, erroneous title. And no one has claimed for it. In fact, what I did, I went one step further. I went down to the bank. I told them I'm getting a legal title on my property. I said, will you give me a loan on it? He said, probably not.
You know why?
He can't foreclose on it.
Because if you default, they can't come and foreclose on it. The county can't tax it. The city can't tax it. They can't tell you what you can build or can't build on it. They can't zone it. They can't screw with you if you have a patent on your land. You don't think land patents are real? Then why is the Supreme Court ruling on it? Look it up yourself. I'm going to give you the science. The lands in question were situated in Mobile, Alabama, adjacent to Mobile Bay. In discussing the subject of federal jurisdiction, the court held, quote, we think a proper examination of the subject will show that the United States never held any municipal sovereignty, jurisdiction, or right of soil in and to the territory of which Alabama or any of the new states were formed. Because the United States have no constitutional capacity to exercise municipal jurisdiction, sovereignty, or eminent domain within the limits of a state or elsewhere, except in the cases in which it is expressly granted, Alabama is therefore entitled to the sovereignty and jurisdiction over all the territory within her limits subject to the common law, end quote. How many of you have been told there's no common law? How many of you have heard Dan Rather Not on television talk about the Looney Tunes people who believe in common law? Here's the Supreme Court recognizing common law, right here. Wow. And how many of you believe that Dan Rather Not knows anything at all? The single most important case regarding the subject of federal jurisdiction appears to be which sets forth the law on this point fully. Here, the railroad company property, which passed through the Fort Leavenworth federal enclave, was being subjected to taxation by Kansas, and the company claimed an exemption from state taxation because its property was within federal jurisdiction and outside of that state. In holding that the railroad company's property could be taxed, the court carefully explained federal jurisdiction within the states. Quote, the consent of the states to the purchase of lands within them for the special purposes named is, however, essential under the Constitution to the transfer to the general government with the title of political jurisdiction and domination where lands are acquired without such consent, the possession of the United States, unless political jurisdiction be ceded to them in some other way, is simply that of an ordinary proprietor. In other words, they have no special status, and they're subject to the jurisdiction of the state. Exclusive jurisdiction. The property in that case, unless used as a means to carry out the purposes of the government, is subject to the legislative authority and control of the states equally with the property of private individuals, end quote. Boy, have they pulled the wool over our eyes or what? Thus, the cases decided within the 19th century clearly disclosed the extent and scope of both state and federal jurisdiction. In essence, these cases, among many others, hold that the jurisdiction of any particular state is coextensive with its borders or territory, and all persons and property located or found therein are subject to that jurisdiction. This jurisdiction is superior. Federal jurisdiction results from a conveyance of state jurisdiction to the federal government for lands owned or otherwise possessed by the federal government, and thus federal jurisdiction is extremely limited in nature. There is no federal jurisdiction if there be no grant or cession of jurisdiction by the state to the federal government. Therefore, federal territorial jurisdiction exists only in Washington, D.C., the federal enclaves within the states, and the territories and insular possessions of the United States, period. The above principles of jurisdiction established in the last century continue their validity today. Nothing has changed, with only one minor exception. In the last century, the cessions of jurisdiction by states to the federal government were by legislative acts which typically ceded full jurisdiction to the federal government, thus placing in the hands of the federal government the troublesome problem of dealing with and governing scattered, localized federal enclaves which had been totally surrendered by the states. With the advent of this century, of large federal works projects and national parks, the problems regarding management of these areas by the federal government were magnified. During the last century, it was thought that if a state ceded jurisdiction to the federal government, the cession granted full and complete jurisdiction. But with the ever-increasing number of separate tracts of land falling within the jurisdiction of the federal government in this century, it was obviously determined by both federal and state public officials that the states should retain greater control over these ceded lands, and the courts have acknowledged the constitutionality of varying degrees of state jurisdiction and control over lands so ceded. You guys thought I was going to tell you that the government had more power, did you? They have even less. It's not bad news, it's good news. One of the first cases to acknowledge the proposition that a state could retain some jurisdiction over property ceded to the federal government was Surplus Trading Company versus Cook, 281 United States Supreme Court, 647, 50, S.C.T.455, 1930. Here, a state attempts to assess an ad valorem tax to an on army blankets located within a federal army camp was found invalid and beyond the state's jurisdiction. But in regards to the proposition that a state could make a qualified cession of jurisdiction to the federal government, the court held, quote, the state undoubtedly may cede her jurisdiction to the United States and may make the cession either absolute or qualified, as to her may appear desirable, provided the qualification is consistent with the purposes for which the reservation is maintained and is accepted by the United States, and where such a cession is made and accepted, it will be determinative of the jurisdiction of both the United States and the state within the reservation, end quote. How could they rule otherwise? It's a contract, and the Constitution protects the right of contract. So anything which is contracted between the state and the United States regarding a cession of land and contracting limited jurisdiction must stand, or the right of contract can't stand. And since it's a constitutional right, it's going to stand. So if in ceding property to the federal government, the state reserves the right of limited jurisdiction and makes that a contractual reservation in ceding the land to the United States, and the United States accepts that reservation as a part of the contract, it becomes law. Two cases decided in 1937 by the United States Supreme Court further clarify the constitutionality of a reservation of partial state jurisdiction over land ceded to the jurisdiction of the United States. In James v. Drabo Contracting Company, 302 United States Supreme Court, 134, 58, S.C.T.208, 1937, the state of West Virginia sought to impose a tax upon the gross receipts of the company arising from a contract which it had made with the United States to build some dams. One of the issues involved in this case was the validity of the state tax imposed on the receipts derived by the company from work performed on lands to which the state had ceded, quote, current, end quote, jurisdiction to the United States. The court held that a state could reserve and qualify any cession of jurisdiction for lands owned by the United States. Since the state had done so here, the court upheld this part of the challenged tax, notwithstanding a partial cession of jurisdiction to the United States. A similar result occurred in Silas Mason Company versus Tax Commission of the State of Washington, 302 United States Supreme Court, 186, 58, S.C.T.233, 1937. Here the United States was undertaking the construction of several dams on the Columbia River in Washington and had purchased the lands necessary for the project. Silas Mason obtained a contract to build a part of the Grand Coulee Dam, but filed suit challenging the Washington income tax when that state sought to impose that tax on the contract proceeds. Mason's argument that the federal government had exclusive jurisdiction over both the lands and its contract was not upheld by either the Supreme Court of Washington or the United States Supreme Court. The latter court held that none of the lands owned by the United States were within its jurisdiction, and thus Washington clearly had jurisdiction to oppose the challenged tax. See also Wilson versus Cox, 327 United States Supreme Court, 474, 66, S.C.T.663, 1946. Some few years later, in 1943, the Supreme Court was again presented with similar taxation and jurisdiction issues. The facts in these two cases were identical, with the exception that one clearly involved land ceded to the jurisdiction of the United States. This single difference caused directly opposite results in both cases. In the question involved the applicability of state law to a contract entered into and performed on a federal enclave to which jurisdiction had been ceded to the United States. During World War II, California passed a law setting a minimum price for the sale of milk, and this law imposed penalties for sales made below the regulated price. Do you understand what I'm talking about here? They're making rulings on jurisdiction on things called buying the price of milk, and today they're putting people in prison where they clearly have no jurisdiction whatsoever for, you know, things that are just incredible. Here, Pacific Coast Dairy consummated a contract on Moffett Field, a federal enclave within the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States, to sell milk to such a federal facility at below the regulated price. When this occurred, California sought to impose a penalty for what it perceived as a violation of state law. But the U.S. Supreme Court refused to permit the enforcement of the California law, holding that the contract was made and performed in a territory outside the jurisdiction of California and within the jurisdiction of the United States, a place where this law did not apply. Thus, in this case, the existence of federal jurisdiction was the foundation for the decision. However, in an opposite result was reached on almost identical facts. Here, Pennsylvania likewise had a law which regulated the price of milk and penalized milk sales below the regulated price. During World War II, the United States leased some land from Pennsylvania for the construction of a military camp. Who knows the answer to this already?
It's
leased. It wasn't ceded. Since the land was leased, Pennsylvania did not cede jurisdiction to the United States. When 10 dairies sold milk to the military facility for a price below the regulated price, the commission sought to impose the penalty. In this case, since there was no federal jurisdiction, the Supreme Court found that the state law applied and permitted the imposition of the penalty. These two cases clearly show the different results which can occur with the presence or absence of federal jurisdiction. And it's based upon what? Really simple, easily researched act. Well, whether or not the state ceded the land to the federal government and did not retain limited jurisdiction, or did, in which case you would have to find out what jurisdiction was reserved to the state. Nothing difficult about it, is there? A final point regarding federal jurisdiction concerns the question of when such jurisdiction ends or ceases. This issue was considered in SRA versus Minnesota, 327 United States Supreme Court, 558, 563-64, 66 S period, CP period, 749, 1946. Which involved the power of the state to tax the real property interest of a purchaser of lands sold by the United States. Here, a federal post office building was sold to SRA pursuant to a real estate sale contract which provided that title would pass, listen to this carefully, which provided that title would pass only after the purchase price had been paid. In refuting the argument of SRA that the ad valorem tax on its equitable interest in the property was really an unlawful tax on United States property, the court held, quote, in the absence of some provisions, a transfer of property held by the United States under state sessions pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution would leave numerous isolated islands of federal jurisdiction. Unless the unrestricted transfer of the property to private hands is thought without more to revest sovereignty in the states, as the purpose of Clause 17 was to give control over the sites of governmental operations to the United States. When such control was deemed essential for federal activities, it would seem that the sovereignty of the United States would end with the reason for its existence and the disposition of the property. We shall treat this case as though the government's unrestricted transfer of property to non-federal hands is a relinquishment of the exclusive legislative power. End quote. Thus, when any property within the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States is no longer utilized by that government for governmental purposes, and the title or any interest therein is conveyed to private interests, the jurisdiction of the federal government ceases and jurisdiction once again reverts to the state. The above principles regarding the distinction between state and federal jurisdiction continue today. See Paul versus United States, 371, United States Supreme Court, 245, 83, S period, CT period, 426, 1963, and United States versus State Tax Commission of Mississippi, 412, United States Supreme Court, 363, 93, S period, CT period, 2183, 1973. What was definitely decided in the beginning days of this republic regarding the extent, scope, and reach of each of these two distinct jurisdictions remains unchanged and forms the foundation and basis for the smooth workings of state governmental systems in conjunction with the federal government. Without such jurisdictional principles which form a clear boundary between the jurisdiction of the states and the United States, our federal governmental system would have surely met its demise long before now. Can the federal government get together with officials of a state government and make an agreement that the federal government can have jurisdiction within a state over certain crimes or certain territory or certain property? Absolutely not. It's unconstitutional. Constitutional doesn't give them any right to do that. In fact, it forbids states from entering into treaties. No, they can't do it, not without amending the Constitution. The federal government is restricted to the powers which were granted to it and can have no other powers regardless of the circumstances involved. How about that?
Can they do it under contract?
Pardon?
Can they enter into a contract?
No, a contract between the federal government and a state is a treaty. That's what a treaty is. A treaty is a contract between two foreign bodies.
Even if they accept money for it?
Cannot. It's unconstitutional. It's a treaty. Many treaties are entered into with special considerations, usually following war. You give us $200 million in gold, we'll agree not to come over and squish your people. It's a treaty. Contract between states is a treaty. Pure and simple. The states are forbidden to enter into treaties. So, the agreement between the Internal Revenue Service and the individual several states are unconstitutional and unlawful. The federal government cannot enter into the state to tax the citizens of the state's income. Besides that, I don't know anybody that has an income anyway. You know what created the state income tax? Based upon the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 26, an agreement entered into between the federal government and the state, whereby the state agreed to allow the federal government to require its employees who live within the several states to file and pay income tax. Did you know that? It's the truth. If the federal income tax is unlawful and unconstitutional when applied to the citizens of the states, so is, by virtue of that agreement, the state income tax. Since they use the same regulations anyway, and it was they were not created or passed into law by the state legislature, it's unconstitutional. And I mean unconstitutional from the constitution of the state.
Piggyback.
That's exactly what they did. They piggybacked the federal regulations onto the state citizens. In every state where there's a state income tax.
Why would it become law under common law if it existed for more than 7 years to become law?
No. Because it's based upon a treaty which is unconstitutional. Anything that's unconstitutional is null and void from its very inception. Has no force of law. Except with stupid people who do it anyway. Right, Gary?
That's right. What's wrong with it?
Does everybody understand? Now, you go back and you try to tell people this, they're going to laugh at you and say, well, they wouldn't do that if it was unconstitutional. And sure. Yeah, that's what they said in Germany when Hitler came along and did all his stuff. Well, our Hitler wouldn't do it if it wasn't good for all of us, all of Germany. We may be Jews, and he's just doing this, you know, to get the crime off the streets, and pretty soon everything's going to be fine. Was it? Is it? No. They wouldn't do that, would they? Thus, when any property within the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States is no longer utilized by that government for governmental purposes, and the title or any interest therein is conveyed to private interests, the jurisdiction of the federal government ceases, and jurisdiction once again reverts to the state. So just because the federal government exercises and has lawfully and constitutional jurisdiction over a piece of land, doesn't mean that it always has that jurisdiction over that piece of land. In fact, some people might even argue that even if they didn't sell it to a private individual or concern, that just the fact that it is no longer serving a governmental purpose may relinquish federal jurisdiction, but that's something that the Supreme Court would have to decide. But I know people put forth that argument. These principles regarding the distinction between state and federal jurisdiction continue today. In summary, the jurisdiction of the states is essentially the same as they possessed when they were leagued together under the Articles of Confederation. Constitution didn't change a thing. Neither has any case law or anything that has happened since. There have been no amendments to the Constitution to change it either. The Confederated States possessed absolute, this is what I said, absolute, that means without reservation, without challenge, without any hope of any kind of anybody else being able to come along and say, hey, I got a piece of that action. Absolute, complete and full jurisdiction over property and persons located within their borders. It is hypocritical to assume or argue that these states, which had banished the centralized power and jurisdiction of the English Parliament and Crown over them by the Declaration of Independence, would shortly thereafter cede comparable power and jurisdiction to the Confederation Congress. They did not, and they closely and jealously guarded their own rights, powers, and jurisdiction, just as I still do today. People call me crazy and nuts. When the Articles were replaced by the Constitution, the intent and purpose of the states was to retain their same powers and jurisdiction with a small concession of jurisdiction to the United States of lands found essential for the operation of that government. However, even this provision did not operate to instantly change any aspect of state jurisdiction. It only permitted its future operation, wherein any state, by its own volition, should choose to cede jurisdiction to the United States. By the adoption of the Constitution, the states jointly surrendered some 17 specific and well-defined powers to the Federal Congress, which related almost entirely to external affairs of the states. Did you hear what I said? External affairs of the states, not within the states. Any single delegated power, or even several powers combined, do not operate in a fashion so as to invade or divest a state of its jurisdiction. As against a single state, the remainder of the states under the Constitution have no right to jurisdiction within the single state absent its consent. The only provision in the Constitution which permits territorial jurisdiction to be vested in the United States is found in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, which provides the mechanism for a voluntary cession of jurisdiction from any state to the United States. When the Constitution was adopted, the United States had jurisdiction over no lands within the states, and it possessed jurisdiction only in the lands encompassed in the Northwest Territories. Shortly after formation of the Union, Maryland and Virginia ceded jurisdiction to the United States for Washington, D.C. Over time, the states have ceded jurisdiction to federal enclaves within the states. Today, the territorial jurisdiction of the United States is found only in such ceded areas, which encompass Washington, D.C., the federal enclaves within the states, and such territories and possessions which may now be owned by the United States. These conclusions are buttressed by the opinion of the federal government itself. In June 1957, the United States government published a work entitled Jurisdiction Over Federal Areas Within the States, Report of the Interdepartmental Committee for the Study of Jurisdiction Over Federal Areas Within the States. Part 2, and this report, is the definitive study on this issue. Therein, the committee stated, and I quote, "The Constitution gives express recognition to but one means of federal acquisition of legislative jurisdiction." Now, did you hear what I just said? Did you hear this admission? Who heard what I said? Who knows? Who understands already? Yes, Jim? You got it. Did you hear what they said? They admitted. This is their own admission. I didn't make this up. This is their report. They claim this is the definitive report. Listen to this again. You must learn to listen carefully and educate your brain to understand what is being said. Because a lot of times what you think is being said isn't what is being said at all. Okay? It went right over most of your heads. You didn't even hear it. You didn't even hear it. And it is a damning omission. The Constitution gives express recognition to but one means of federal acquisition of legislative jurisdiction. Act of Congress. Act of Congress has no authority or force of law within the states. How about that? How many of you are going around paying fees and getting licenses and obeying rules that were made law by Act of Congress? I'm going to read this again. I may read it 20 times. The Constitution gives express recognition to but one means of federal acquisition of legislative jurisdiction. By state consent under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, Justice McLean suggested that the Constitution provided the sole mode for transfer of jurisdiction, and that if this mode is not pursued, no transfer of jurisdiction can take place, end quote. Period. Subject ended. That's it. Period. People come to me and say, "Well, I don't know how you did it, but you're going to jail." They might kill me, folks, but I ain't going to jail. Because I know and understand the law. They have no authority to put me in jail. If I go to jail, it'll be because I asked them to put me there. 99.9% of all people who are in jail are there because they volunteered to go. Volunteered, and I'm not kidding. And the very real possibility they might kill me is why you see me wearing a gun all the time, and why we have Crusher. Which, by the way, for those of you who don't know Crusher, he's the dog over there, the black dog outside our cabin. Don't mess with him, he will kill you. If you mess with one of us and he's not on that chain, he will kill you. Because that's what he's been trained to do.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today's broadcast. In case you didn't catch the beginning of the broadcast, Federal District Court Judge Irwin today in Phoenix, Arizona, issued a bench warrant for the arrest of me, William Cooper, and my wife, Annie Cooper, because we did not show up in his courtroom on a summons that was never served upon us. His bench warrant is unconstitutional, unlawful, and illegal. Federal courts disobey the law all the time. Not only that, the United States District Court has no jurisdiction within the territorial boundaries of the state of Arizona over any of the persons, properties, or business within those boundaries, except on land ceded by the state legislature to the federal government. Good night, folks. We'll be right here. And should anybody come and attempt to arrest us, we will use whatever force necessary to defeat them and to prevail. We are the constitutional, constituted, unorganized militia, and we will enforce the laws of the Union. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. Listening to 101.1 FM Eager, probably the last voice of freedom left in this country. 101.1 FM is your community service, nonprofit radio station. While we're standing here fighting for freedom, fighting in defense of the Constitution, and for all of the rights of the American citizens, what are you doing for your community?